Random House Audio presents Unbroken, a World War II story of survival, resilience, and redemption by Laura Hillenbrand. This is Edward Herman. What stays with you latest and deepest? Of curious panics, of hard-fought engagements or sieges tremendous. What deepest remains? Walt Whitman, The Wound Dresser. Preface. All he could see, in every direction, was water. It was June 23, 1943. Somewhere on the endless expanse of the Pacific Ocean, Army Air Force's bombardier and Olympic runner, Louis Zamperini, lay across a small raft, drifting westward. Slumped alongside him was a sergeant, one of his plane's gunners. On a separate raft, tethered to the first, lay another crewman, a gash zigzagging across his forehead. Their bodies, burned by the sun and stained yellow from the raft dye, had winnowed down to skeletons. Sharks glided in lazy loops around them, dragging their backs along the rafts, waiting. The men had been adrift for 27 days. Borne by an equatorial current, they had floated at least 1,000 miles, deep into Japanese-controlled waters. The rafts were beginning to deteriorate into jelly and gave off a sour, burning odor. The men's bodies were pocked with salt sores, and their lips were so swollen that they pressed into their nostrils and chins. They spent their days with their eyes fixed on the sky, singing White Christmas, muttering about food. No one was even looking for them anymore. They were alone on 64 million square miles of ocean. A month earlier, 26-year-old Zamperini had been one of the greatest runners in the world, expected by many to be the first to break the 4-minute mile, one of the most celebrated barriers in sport. Now his Olympian's body had wasted to less than 100 pounds, and his famous legs could no longer lift him. Almost everyone, outside of his family, had given him up for dead. On that morning of the 27th day, the men heard a distant, deep strumming. Every airman knew that sound. Pistons. Their eyes caught a glint in the sky, a plane high overhead. Zamperini fired two flares and shook powder dye into the water, enveloping the rafts in a circle of vivid orange. The plane kept going, slowly disappearing. The men sagged. Then the sound returned, and the plane came back into view. The crew had seen them. With arms shrunken to little more than bone and yellowed skin, the castaways waved and shouted, their voices thin from thirst. The plane dropped low and swept alongside the rafts. Zamperini saw the profiles of the crewmen, dark against bright blueness. There was a terrific roaring sound. The water and the rafts themselves seemed to boil. It was machine gun fire. This was not an American rescue plane. It was a Japanese bomber. The men pitched themselves into the water and hung together under the rafts, cringing as bullets punched through the rubber and sliced effervescent lines in the water around their faces. The firing blazed on, then sputtered out as the bomber overshot them. The men dragged themselves back onto the one raft that was still mostly inflated. The bomber banked sideways, circling toward them again. As it leveled off, Zamperini could see the muzzles of the machine guns aimed directly at them. Zamperini looked toward his crewmates. They were too weak to go back in the water. As they lay down on the floor of the raft, hands over their heads, Zamperini splashed overboard alone. Somewhere beneath him, the sharks were done waiting. They bent their bodies in the water and swam toward the man under the raft. Part 1. Chapter 1. The One Boy Insurgency. In the pre-dawn darkness of August 26, 1929, in the back bedroom of a small house in Torrance, California, a 12-year-old boy sat up in bed listening. There was a sound coming from outside, growing ever louder. It was a huge, heavy rush, suggesting immensity, a great parting of air. It was coming from directly above the house. The boy swung his legs off his bed, raced down the stairs, slapped open the back door, and loped onto the grass. The yard was otherworldly, smothered in unnatural darkness, shivering with sound. The boy stood on the lawn beside his older brother, head thrown back, spellbound. The sky had disappeared. An object that he could see only in silhouette, reaching across a massive arc of space, was suspended low in the air over the house. It was longer than 2.5 football fields, and as tall as a city. It was putting out the stars. What he saw was the German dirigible Graf Zeppelin. At nearly 800 feet long and 110 feet high, it was the largest flying machine ever crafted. More luxurious than the finest airplane, gliding effortlessly over huge distances, built on a scale that left spectators gasping, it was, in the summer of 29, the wonder of the world. The airship was 3 days from completing a sensational feat of aeronautics, circumnavigation of the globe. The journey had begun on August 7th when the Zeppelin had slipped its tethers in Lakehurst, New Jersey, lifted up with a long, slow sigh, and headed for Manhattan. On Fifth Avenue that summer, demolition was soon to begin on the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, clearing the way for a skyscraper of unprecedented proportions, the Empire State Building. At Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, players were debuting numbered uniforms. Lou Gehrig wore number 4. Babe Ruth, about to hit his 500th home run, wore number 3. On Wall Street, stock prices were racing toward an all-time high. After a slow glide around the Statue of Liberty, the Zeppelin banked north, then turned out over the Atlantic. In time, land came below again. France, Switzerland, Germany. The ship passed over Nuremberg, where fringe politician Adolf Hitler, whose Nazi party had been trounced in the 1928 elections, had just delivered a speech touting selective infanticide. Then it flew east to Frankfurt, where a Jewish woman named Edith Frank was caring for her newborn, a girl named Anne. Sailing northeast, the Zeppelin crossed over Russia. Siberian villagers, so isolated that they'd never even seen a train, fell to their knees at the sight of it. On August 19th, as some 4 million Japanese waved handkerchiefs and shouted Banzai, the Zeppelin circled Tokyo and sank onto a landing field. 4 days later, as the German and Japanese anthems played, the ship rose into the grasp of a typhoon that whisked it over the Pacific at breathtaking speed toward America. Passengers, gazing from the window, saw only the ship's shadow, following it along the clouds, like a huge shark swimming alongside. When the clouds parted, the passengers glimpsed giant creatures turning in the sea that looked like monsters. On August 25th, the Zeppelin reached San Francisco. After being cheered down the California coast, it slid through sunset into darkness and silence and across midnight. As slow as the drifting wind, it passed over Torrance, where its only audience was a scattering of drowsy souls, among them the boy in his pajamas behind the house on Gramercy Avenue. Standing under the airship, his feet bare in the grass, he was transfixed. It was, he would say, fearfully beautiful. He could feel the rumble of the craft's engines tilling the air, but couldn't make out the silver skin, the sweeping ribs, the finned tail. He could see only the blackness of the space it inhabited. It was not a great presence, but a great absence, a geometric ocean of darkness that seemed to swallow heaven itself. The boy's name was Louis Silvier Zamperini. The son of Italian immigrants, he had come into the world in Olean, New York, on January 26, 1917, 11.5 pounds of baby under black hair as coarse as barbed wire. His father, Anthony, had been living on his own since age 14, first as a coal miner and boxer, then as a construction worker. His mother, Louise, was a petite, playful beauty, 16 at marriage and 18 when Louis was born. In their apartment, where only Italian was spoken, Louise and Anthony called their boy Toots. From the moment he could walk, Louis couldn't bear to be corralled. His siblings would recall him careening about, hurdling flora, fauna, and furniture. The instant Louise thumped him into a chair and told him to be still, he vanished. If she didn't have her squirming boy clutched in her hands, she usually had no idea where he was. In 1919, when 2-year-old Louis was down with pneumonia, he climbed out his bedroom window, descended one story, and went on a naked tear down the street with a policeman chasing him and a crowd watching in amazement. Soon after, on a pediatrician's advice, Louise and Anthony decided to move their children to the warmer climes of California. Sometime after their train pulled out of Grand Central Station, Louis bolted, ran the length of the train, and leapt from the caboose. Standing with his frantic mother as the train rolled backward in search of the lost boy, Louis's older brother, Pete, spotted Louis, strolling up the track in perfect serenity. Swept up in his mother's arms, Louis smiled. "I knew you'd come back," he said in Italian. In California, Anthony landed a job as a railway electrician and bought a half-acre field on the edge of Torrance, population 1,800. He and Louise hammered up a one-room shack with no running water, an outhouse behind, and a roof that leaked so badly that they had to keep buckets on the beds. With only hook latches for locks, Louise took to sitting by the front door on an apple box with a rolling pin in her hand, ready to brain any prowlers who might threaten her children. There, and at the Gramercy Avenue house where they settled a year later, Louise kept prowlers out, but couldn't keep Louis in hand. Contesting a foot race across a busy highway, he just missed getting broadsided by a jalopy. At 5, he started smoking, picking up discarded cigarette butts while walking to kindergarten. He began drinking one night when he was 8. He hid under the dinner table, snatched glasses of wine, drank them all dry, staggered outside, and fell into a rose bush. On one day, Louise discovered that Louis had impaled his leg on a bamboo beam. On another, she had to ask a neighbor to sew Louis's severed toe back on. When Louis came home drenched in oil after scaling an oil rig, diving into a sump well, and nearly drowning, it took a gallon of turpentine and a lot of scrubbing before Anthony recognized his son again. Thrilled by the crashing of boundaries, Louis was untamable. As he grew into his uncommonly clever mind, mere feats of daring were no longer satisfying. In Torrance, a one-boy insurgency was born. If it was edible, Louis stole it. He skulked down alleys, a roll of lockpicking wire in his pocket. Housewives who stepped from their kitchens would return to find that their suppers had disappeared. Residents looking out their back windows might catch a glimpse of a long-legged boy dashing down the alley, a whole cake balanced on his hands. When a local family left Louis off their dinner party guest list, he broke into their house, bribed their Great Dane with a bone, and cleaned out their icebox. At another party, he absconded with an entire keg of beer. When he discovered that the cooling tables at Meinzer's Bakery stood within an arm's length of the back door, he began picking the lock, snatching pies, eating until he was full, and reserving the rest as ammunition for ambushes. When rival thieves took up the racket, he suspended the stealing until the culprits were caught and the bakery owners dropped their guard. Then he ordered his friends to rob Meinzer's again. It is a testament to the content of Louis's childhood that his stories about it usually ended with, "And then I ran like mad." He was often chased by people he had robbed, and at least 2 people threatened to shoot him. To minimize the evidence found on him when the police habitually came his way, he set up loot stashing sites around town, including a 3-seater cave that he dug in a nearby forest. Under the Torrance High bleachers, Pete once found a stolen wine jug that Louis had hidden there. It was teeming with inebriated ants. In the lobby of the Torrance Theater, Louis stopped up the pay telephone coin slots with toilet paper. He returned regularly to feed wire behind the coins stacked up inside, hook the paper, and fill his palms with change. A metal dealer never guessed that the grinning Italian kid who often came by to sell him armfuls of copper scrap had stolen the same scrap from his lot the night before. Discovering, while scuffling with an enemy at a circus, that adults would give quarters to fighting kids to pacify them, Louis declared a truce with the enemy, and they cruised around staging brawls before strangers. To get even with a railcar conductor who wouldn't stop for him, Louis greased the rails. When a teacher made him stand in a corner for spitballing, he deflated her car tires with toothpicks. After setting a legitimate Boy Scout state record in friction fire ignition, he broke his record by soaking his tinder in gasoline and mixing it with match heads, causing a small explosion. He stole a neighbor's coffee percolator tube, set up a sniper's nest in a tree, crammed pepper tree berries into his mouth, spat them through the tube, and sent the neighborhood girls running. His magnum opus became legend. Late one night, Louis climbed the steeple of a Baptist church, rigged the bell with piano wire, strung the wire into a nearby tree, and roused the police, the fire department, and all of Torrance with apparently spontaneous pealing. The more credulous townsfolk called it a sign from God. Only one thing scared him. When Louis was in late boyhood, a pilot landed a plane near Torrance and took Louis up for a flight. One might have expected such an intrepid child to be ecstatic, but the speed and altitude frightened him. From that day on, he wanted nothing to do with airplanes. In a childhood of artful dodging, Louis made more than just mischief. He shaped who he would be in manhood. Confident that he was clever, resourceful, and bold enough to escape any predicament, he was almost incapable of discouragement. When history carried him into war, this resilient optimism would define him. Louis was 20 months younger than his brother, who was everything he was not. Pete Zamperini was handsome, popular, impeccably groomed, polite to elders and avuncular to juniors, silky smooth with girls and blessed with such sound judgment that even when he was a child, his parents consulted him on difficult decisions. He ushered his mother into her seat at dinner, turned in at 7, and tucked his alarm clock under his pillow so as not to wake Louis, with whom he shared a bed. He rose at 2:30 to run a 3-hour paper route and deposited all his earnings in the bank, which would swallow every penny when the Depression hit. He had a lovely singing voice and a gallant habit of carrying pins in his pant cuffs in case his dance partner's dress strap failed. He once saved a girl from drowning. Pete radiated a gentle but impressive authority that led everyone he met, even adults, to be swayed by his opinion. Even Louis, who made a religion out of heeding no one, did as Pete said. Louis idolized Pete, who watched over him and their younger sisters, Sylvia and Virginia, with paternal protectiveness. But Louis was eclipsed, and he never heard the end of it. Sylvia would recall her mother tearfully telling Louis how she wished he could be more like Pete. What made it more galling was that Pete's reputation was part myth. Though Pete earned grades little better than Louis's failing ones, his principal assumed that he was a straight-A student. On the night of Torrance's church bell miracle, a well-directed flashlight would have revealed Pete's legs dangling from the tree alongside Louis's. And Louis wasn't always the only Zamperini boy who could be seen sprinting down the alley with food that had lately belonged to the neighbors. But it never occurred to anyone to suspect Pete of anything. Pete never got caught, said Sylvia. Louis always got caught. Nothing about Louis fit with other kids. He was a puny boy, and in his first years in Torrance, his lungs were still compromised enough from the pneumonia that in picnic foot races, every girl in town could dust him. His features, which would later settle into pleasant collaboration, were growing at different rates, giving him a curious face that seemed designed by committee. His ears leaned sidelong off his head like holstered pistols, and above them waved a calamity of black hair that mortified him. He attacked it with his Aunt Margie's hot iron, hobbled it in a silk stocking every night, and slathered it with so much olive oil that flies trailed him to school. It did no good. And then there was his ethnicity. In Torrance, in the early 1920s, Italians were held in such disdain that when the Zamperinis arrived, the neighbors petitioned the city council to keep them out. Louis, who knew only a smattering of English until he was in grade school, couldn't hide his pedigree. He survived kindergarten by keeping mum. But in first grade, when he blurted out, "Brutte bastarde," at another kid, his teachers caught on. They compounded his misery by holding him back a grade. He was a marked boy. Bullies, drawn by his oddity and hoping to goad him into uttering Italian curses, pelted him with rocks, taunted him, punched him, and kicked him. He tried buying their mercy with his lunch, but they pummeled him anyway, leaving him bloody. He could have ended the beatings by running away or succumbing to tears, but he refused to do either. "You could beat him to death," said Sylvia, "and he wouldn't say ouch or cry. He just put his hands in front of his face and took it." As Louis neared his teens, he took a hard turn. Aloof and bristling, he lurked around the edges of Torrance, his only friendships forged loosely with rough boys who followed his lead. He became so germophobic that he wouldn't tolerate anyone coming near his food. Though he could be a sweet boy, he was often short-tempered and obstreperous. He feigned toughness, but was secretly tormented. Kids passing into parties would see him lingering outside, unable to work up the courage to walk in. Frustrated at his inability to defend himself, he made a study of it. His father taught him how to work a punching bag and made him a barbell from two lead-filled coffee cans welded to a pipe. The next time a bully came at Louis, he ducked left and swung his right fist straight into the boy's mouth. The bully shrieked, his tooth broken, and fled. The feeling of lightness that Louis experienced on his walk home was one he would never forget. Over time, Louis's temper grew wilder, his fuse shorter, his skills sharper. He socked a girl. He pushed a teacher. He pelted a policeman with rotten tomatoes. Kids who crossed him wound up with fat lips, and bullies learned to give him a wide berth. He once came upon Pete in their front yard in a standoff with another boy. Both boys had their fists in front of their chins, each waiting for the other to swing. "Louis can't stand it," remembered Pete. "He's standing there. Hit him, Pete. Hit him, Pete." "I'm waiting there, and all of a sudden Louis turns around and smacks this guy right in the gut. And then he runs." Anthony Zamperini was at his wit's end. The police always seemed to be on the front porch, trying to talk sense into Louis. There were neighbors to be apologized to and damages to be compensated for with money that Anthony couldn't spare. Adoring his son, but exasperated by his behavior, Anthony delivered frequent forceful spankings. Once, after he'd caught Louis wriggling through a window in the middle of the night, he delivered a kick to the rear so forceful that it lifted Louis off the floor. Louis absorbed the punishment in tearless silence, then committed the same crimes again, just to show he could. Louis's mother, Louise, took a different tack. Louis was a copy of herself, right down to the vivid blue eyes. When pushed, she shoved. Sold a bad cut of meat, she'd march down to the butcher, frying pan in hand. Loving mischief, she spread icing over a cardboard box and presented it as a birthday cake to a neighbor, who promptly got the knife stuck. When Pete told her he'd drink his castor oil if she gave him a box of candy, she agreed, watched him drink it, then handed him an empty candy box. "You only asked for the box, honey," she said with a smile. "That's all I got." And she understood Louis's restiveness. One Halloween, she dressed as a boy and raced around town trick-or-treating with Louis and Pete. A gang of kids, thinking she was one of the local toughs, tackled her and tried to steal her pants. Little Louise Zamperini, mother of four, was deep in the melee when the cops picked her up for brawling. Knowing that punishing Louis would only provoke his defiance, Louise took a surreptitious route toward reforming him. In search of an informant, she worked over Louis's schoolmates with homemade pie and turned up a soft boy named Hugh, whose sweet tooth was Louis's undoing. Louise suddenly knew everything Louis was up to, and her children wondered if she had developed psychic powers. Sure that Sylvia was snitching, Louis refused to sit at the supper table with her, eating his meals in spiteful solitude off the open oven door. He once became so enraged with her that he chased her around the block. Outrunning Louis for the only time in her life, Sylvia cut down the alley and dove into her father's workshed. Louis flushed her out by feeding his 3-foot-long pet snake into the crawl space. She then locked herself in the family car and didn't come out for an entire afternoon. "It was a matter of life and death," she said, some 75 years later. For all her efforts, Louise couldn't change Louis. He ran away and wandered around San Diego for days, sleeping under a highway overpass. He tried to ride a steer in a pasture, got tossed onto the ragged edge of a fallen tree, and limped home with a gashed knee bound in a handkerchief. 27 stitches didn't tame him. He hit one kid so hard that he broke his nose. He upended another boy and stuffed paper towels in his mouth. Parents forbade their kids from going near him. A farmer, furious over Louis's robberies, loaded his shotgun with rock salt and blasted him in the tail. Louis beat one kid so badly, leaving him unconscious in a ditch, that he was afraid he'd killed him. When Louise saw the blood on Louis's fists, she burst into tears. As Louis prepared to start Torrance High, he was looking less like an impish kid and more like a dangerous young man. High school would be the end of his education. There was no money for college. Anthony's paycheck ran out before the week's end, forcing Louise to improvise meals out of eggplant, milk, stale bread, wild mushrooms, and rabbits that Louis and Pete shot in the fields. With flunking grades and no skills, Louis had no chance for a scholarship. It was unlikely that he could land a job. The Depression had come, and the unemployment rate was nearing 25%. Louis had no real ambitions. If asked what he wanted to be, his answer would have been cowboy. In the 1930s, America was infatuated with the pseudoscience of eugenics and its promise of strengthening the human race by culling the unfit from the genetic pool. Along with the feeble-minded, insane, and criminal, those so classified included women who had sex out of wedlock, considered a mental illness, orphans, the disabled, the poor, the homeless, epileptics, masturbators, the blind and the deaf, alcoholics, and girls whose genitals exceeded certain measurements. Some eugenicists advocated euthanasia, and in mental hospitals, this was quietly carried out on scores of people through lethal neglect or outright murder. At one Illinois mental hospital, new patients were dosed with milk from cows infected with tuberculosis, in the belief that only the undesirable would perish. As many as 4 in 10 of these patients died. A more popular tool of eugenics was forced sterilization, employed on a raft of lost souls who, through misbehavior or misfortune, fell into the hands of state governments. By 1930, when Louis was entering his teens, California was enraptured with eugenics and would ultimately sterilize some 20,000 people. When Louis was in his early teens, an event in Torrance brought reality home. A kid from Louis's neighborhood was deemed feeble-minded, institutionalized, and barely saved from sterilization through a frantic legal effort by his parents, funded by their Torrance neighbors. Tutored by Louis's siblings, the boy earned straight A's. Louis was never more than an inch from juvenile hall or jail, and as a serial troublemaker, a failing student, and a suspect Italian, he was just the sort of rogue that eugenicists wanted to cull. Suddenly understanding what he was risking, he felt deeply shaken. The person that Louis had become was not, he knew, his authentic self. He made hesitant efforts to connect to others. He scrubbed the kitchen floor to surprise his mother, but she assumed that Pete had done it. While his father was out of town, Louis overhauled the engine of the family's Marmon Roosevelt straight-eight sedan. He baked biscuits and gave them away. When his mother, tired of the mess, booted him from her kitchen, he resumed baking in a neighbor's house. He doled out nearly everything he stole. He was big-hearted, said Pete. Louis would give away anything, whether it was his or not. Each attempt he made to right himself ended wrong. He holed up alone, reading Zane Grey novels and wishing himself into them, a man and his horse on the frontier, broken off from the world. He haunted the theater for Western movies, losing track of the plots while he stared at the scenery. On some nights, he'd drag his bedding into the yard to sleep alone. On others, he'd lie awake in bed beneath pinups of movie cowboy Tom Mix and his wonder horse Tony, feeling snared on something from which he couldn't break free. In the back bedroom, he could hear trains passing. Lying beside his sleeping brother, he'd listen to the broad, low sound, faint, then rising, faint again, then a high, beckoning whistle, then gone. The sound of it brought goosebumps. Lost in longing, Louis imagined himself on a train, rolling into country he couldn't see, growing smaller and more distant, until he disappeared. Chapter 2. Run Like Mad. The rehabilitation of Louis Zamperini began in 1931 with a key. 14-year-old Louis was in a locksmith shop when he heard someone say that if you put any key in any lock, it has a 1 in 50 chance of fitting. Inspired, Louis began collecting keys and trying locks. He had no luck until he tried his house key on the back door of the Torrance High gym. When basketball season began, there was an inexplicable discrepancy between the number of 10-cent tickets sold and the considerably larger number of kids in the bleachers. In late 1931, someone caught on, and Louis was hauled to the principal's office for the umpteenth time. In California, winter-born students entered new grades in January, so Louis was about to start ninth grade. The principal punished him by making him ineligible for athletic and social activities. Louis, who never joined anything, was indifferent. When Pete learned what had happened, he headed straight to the principal's office. Though his mother didn't yet speak much English, he towed her along to give his presentation weight. He told the principal that Louis craved attention, but had never won it in the form of praise, so he sought it in the form of punishment. If Louis were recognized for doing something right, Pete argued, he'd turn his life around. He asked the principal to allow Louis to join a sport. When the principal balked, Pete asked him if he could live with allowing Louis to fail. It was a cheeky thing for a 16-year-old to say to his principal, but Pete was the one kid in Torrance who could get away with such a remark and make it persuasive. Louis was made eligible for athletics for 1932. Pete had big plans for Louis. A senior in 1931-32, he would graduate with 10 varsity letters, including 3 in basketball and 3 in baseball. But it was track, in which he earned 4 varsity letters, tied the school half-mile record, and set its mile record of 5 minutes 6 seconds, that was his true forte. Looking at Louis, whose getaway speed was his saving grace, Pete thought he saw the same incipient talent. As it turned out, it wasn't Pete who got Louis onto a track for the first time. It was Louis's weakness for girls. In February, the 9th-grade girls began assembling a team for an interclass track meet, and in a class with only 4 boys, Louis was the only male who looked like he could run. The girls worked their charms, and Louis found himself standing on the track, barefoot, for a 660-yard race. When everyone ran, he followed, churning along with jimmying elbows and dropping far behind. As he labored home last, he heard tittering. Gasping and humiliated, he ran straight off the track and hid under the bleachers. The coach muttered something about how that kid belonged anywhere but in a foot race. "He's my brother," Pete replied. From that day on, Pete was all over Louis, forcing him to train, then dragging him to the track to run in a second meet. Urged on by kids in the stands, Louis put in just enough effort to beat one boy and finish 3rd. He hated running, but the applause was intoxicating, and the prospect of more was just enough incentive to keep him marginally compliant. Pete herded him out to train every day and rode his bicycle behind him, whacking him with a stick. Louis dragged his feet, bellyached, and quit at the first sign of fatigue. Pete made him get up and keep going. Louis started winning. At the season's end, he became the first Torrance kid to make the All-City Finals. He finished 5th. Pete had been right about Louis's talent. But to Louis, training felt like one more constraint. At night, he listened to the whistles of passing trains. And one day, in the summer of 32, he couldn't bear it any longer. It began over a chore that Louis's father asked him to do. Louis resisted, a spat ensued, and Louis threw some clothes into a bag and stormed toward the front door. His parents ordered him to stay. Louis was beyond persuasion. As he walked out, his mother rushed to the kitchen and emerged with a sandwich wrapped in wax paper. Louis stuffed it in his bag and left. He was partway down the front walk when he heard his name called. When he turned, there was his father, grim-faced, holding $2 in his outstretched hand. It was a lot of money for a man whose paycheck didn't bridge the week. Louis took it and walked away. He rounded up a friend, and together they hitchhiked to Los Angeles, broke into a car, and slept on the seats. The next day, they jumped a train, climbed onto the roof, and rode north. The trip was a nightmare. The boys got locked in a boxcar so hot that they were soon frantic to escape. Louis found a discarded strip of metal, climbed on his friend's shoulders, pried a vent open, squirmed out, and helped his friend out, badly cutting himself in the process. Then they were discovered by the railroad detective, who forced them to jump from the moving train at gunpoint. After several days of walking, getting chased out of orchards and grocery stores where they tried to steal food, they wound up sitting on the ground in a rail yard, filthy, bruised, sunburned, and wet, sharing a stolen can of beans. A train rattled past. Louis looked up. "I saw beautiful white tablecloths and crystal on the tables, and food, people laughing and enjoying themselves and eating," he said later. "And I was sitting here, shivering, eating a miserable can of beans." He remembered the money in his father's hand, the fear in his mother's eyes as she offered him a sandwich. He stood up and headed home. When Louis walked into his house, Louise threw her arms around him, inspected him for injuries, led him to the kitchen, and gave him a cookie. Anthony came home, saw Louis, and sank into a chair, his face soft with relief. After dinner, Louis went upstairs, dropped into bed, and whispered his surrender to Pete. In the summer of 1932, Louis did almost nothing but run. On the invitation of a friend, he went to stay at a cabin on the Cahuilla Indian Reservation in Southern California's high desert. Each morning, he rose with the sun, picked up his rifle, and jogged into the sagebrush. He ran up and down hills, over the desert, through gullies. He chased bands of horses, darting into the swirling herds and trying in vain to snatch a fistful of mane and swing aboard. He swam in a sulfur spring, watched over by Cahuilla women scrubbing clothes on the rocks, and stretched out to dry himself in the sun. On his run back to the cabin each afternoon, he shot a rabbit for supper. Each evening, he climbed atop the cabin and lay back, reading Zane Grey novels. When the sun sank and the words faded, he gazed over the landscape, moved by its beauty, watching it slip from gray to purple before darkness blended land and sky. In the morning, he rose to run again. He didn't run from something or to something, not for anyone or in spite of anyone. He ran because it was what his body wished to do. The restiveness, the self-consciousness, and the need to oppose disappeared. All he felt was peace. He came home with a mania for running. All of the effort that he'd once put into thieving, he threw into track. On Pete's instruction, he ran his entire paper route for the Torrance Herald, to and from school, and to the beach and back. He rarely stayed on the sidewalk, veering onto neighbors' lawns to hurdle bushes. He gave up drinking and smoking. To expand his lung capacity, he ran to the public pool at Redondo Beach, dove to the bottom, grabbed the drain plug, and just floated there, hanging on a little longer each time. Eventually, he could stay underwater for 3 minutes and 45 seconds. People kept jumping in to save him. Louis also found a role model. In the 1930s, track was hugely popular, and its elite performers were household names. Among them was a Kansas University miler named Glenn Cunningham. As a small child, Cunningham had been in a schoolhouse explosion that killed his brother and left Glenn with severe burns on his legs and torso. It was a month and a half before he could sit up, and more time still before he could stand. Unable to straighten his legs, he learned to push himself about by leaning on a chair, his legs floundering. He graduated to the tail of the family mule, and eventually, hanging off the tail of an obliging horse named Paint, he began to run, a gait that initially caused him excruciating pain. Within a few years, he was racing, setting mile records and obliterating his opponents by the length of a home stretch. By 1932, the modest, mild-tempered Cunningham, whose legs and back were covered in a twisting mesh of scars, was becoming a national sensation, soon to be acclaimed as the greatest miler in American history. Louis had his hero. In the fall of 1932, Pete began his studies at Compton, a tuition-free junior college, where he became a star runner. Nearly every afternoon, he commuted home to coach Louis, running alongside him, subduing the jimmying elbows and teaching him strategy. Louis had a rare biomechanical advantage, hips that rolled as he ran. When one leg reached forward, the corresponding hip swung forward with it, giving Louis an exceptionally efficient 7-foot stride. After watching him from the Torrance high fence, cheerleader Toots Bowersox needed only one word to describe him. Smooth. Pete thought that the sprints in which Louis had been running were too short. He'd be a miler, just like Glenn Cunningham. In January 1933, Louis began 10th grade. As he lost his aloof, thorny manner, he was welcomed by the fashionable crowd. They invited him to Weenie Bakes in front of Kello's Hamburg Stand, where Louis would join ukulele sing-alongs and touch football games played with a knotted towel, contests that inevitably ended with a cheerleader being wedged into a trash can. Capitalizing on his sudden popularity, Louis ran for class president and won, borrowing the speech that Pete had used to win his class presidency at Compton. Best of all, girls suddenly found him dreamy. While walking alone on his 16th birthday, Louis was ambushed by a giggling gaggle of cheerleaders. One girl sat on Louis while the rest gave him 16 whacks on the rear, plus one to grow on. When the school track season began in February, Louis set out to see what training had done for him. His transformation was stunning. Competing in black silk shorts that his mother had sewn from the fabric of a skirt, he won an 880-yard race, breaking the school record, co-held by Pete, by more than 2 seconds. A week later, he ran a field of milers off their feet, stopping the watches at 5 minutes, 3 seconds, 3 seconds faster than Pete's record. At another meet, he clocked a mile in 4 minutes, 58 seconds. 3 weeks later, he set a state record of 4 minutes, 50.6 seconds. By early April, he was down to 4 minutes, 46 seconds. By late April, 4 minutes, 42 seconds. "Boy, oh boy, oh boy," read a local paper. "Can that guy fly? Yes, this means that Zamperini guy." Almost every week, Louis ran the mile, streaking through the season unbeaten and untested. When he ran out of high school kids to whip, he took on Pete and 13 other college runners in a 2-mile race at Compton. Though he was only 16 and had never even trained at the distance, he won by 50 yards. Next, he tried the 2-mile in UCLA's Southern California cross-country meet. Running so effortlessly that he couldn't feel his feet touching the ground, he took the lead and kept pulling away. At the halfway point, he was an eighth of a mile ahead, and observers began speculating on when the boy in the black shorts was going to collapse. Louis didn't collapse. After he flew past the finish, rewriting the course record, he looked back up the long straightaway. Not one of the other runners was even in view. Louis had won by more than a quarter of a mile. He felt as if he would faint, but it wasn't from the exertion. It was from the realization of what he was. Chapter 3. The Torrance Tornado. It happened every Saturday. Louis would go to the track, limber up, lie on his stomach on the infield grass, visualizing his coming race. Then walk to the line, await the pop of the gun, and spring away. Pete would dash back and forth in the infield, clicking his stopwatch, yelling encouragement and instructions. When Pete gave the signal, Louis would stretch out his long legs and his opponents would scatter and drop away, in the words of a reporter, sadly disheartened and disillusioned. Louis would glide over the line. Pete would be there to tackle him, and the kids in the bleachers would cheer and stomp. Then there would be autograph-seeking girls coming in waves, a ride home, kisses from mother, and snapshots on the front lawn, trophy in hand. Louis won so many wristwatches, the traditional laurel of track, that he began handing them out all over town. Periodically, a new golden boy would be touted as the one who would take him down, only to be run off his feet. One victim, wrote a reporter, had been hailed as the boy who doesn't know how fast he can run. He found out Saturday. Louis' supreme high school moment came in the 1934 Southern California Track and Field Championship. Running in what was celebrated as the best field of high school milers in history, Louis routed them all and smoked the mile in 4 minutes 21.3 seconds, shattering the national high school record set during World War I by more than 2 seconds. His main rival so exhausted himself in chasing Louis that he had to be carried from the track. As Louis trotted into Pete's arms, he felt a tug of regret. He felt too fresh. Had he run his second lap faster, he said, he might have clocked 4 minutes 18 seconds. A reporter predicted that Louis's record would stand for 20 years. It stood for 19. Once his hometown's resident arch-villain, Louis was now a superstar, and Torrance forgave him everything. When he trained, people lined the track fence, calling out, "Come on, Iron Man!" The sports pages of the Los Angeles Times and Examiner were striped with stories on the prodigy, whom the Times called the Torrance Tempest, and practically everyone else called the Torrance Tornado. By one report, stories on Louis were such an important source of revenue to the Torrance Herald that the newspaper insured his legs for $50,000. Torrancers carpooled to his races and crammed the grandstands. Embarrassed by the fuss, Louis asked his parents not to watch him race. Louise came anyway, sneaking to the track to peer through the fence, but the races made her so nervous that she had to hide her eyes. Not long ago, Louis's aspirations had ended at whose kitchen he might burgle. Now he latched onto a wildly audacious goal, the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. The games had no mile race, so milers ran the 1,500 meters, about 120 yards short of a mile. It was a seasoned man's game. Most top milers of the era peaked in their mid-20s or later. As of 1934, the Olympic 1500-meter favorite was Glenn Cunningham, who'd set the world record in the mile 4 minutes, 6.8 seconds, just weeks after Louis set the national high school record. Cunningham had been racing since the fourth grade, and at the 1936 Games, he would be just short of 27. He wouldn't run his fastest mile until he was 28. As of 1936, Louis would have only 5 years' experience and would be only 19. But Louis was already the fastest high school miler in American history, and he was improving so rapidly that he had lopped 42 seconds off his time in 2 years. His record mile, run when he was 17, was 3.5 seconds faster than Cunningham's fastest high school mile, run when he was 20. Even conservative track pundits were beginning to think that Louis might be the one to shatter precedent. And after Louis won every race in his senior season, their confidence was strengthened. Louis believed he could do it, and so did Pete. Louis wanted to run in Berlin more than he had ever wanted anything. In December 1935, Louis graduated from high school. A few weeks later, he rang in 1936 with his thoughts full of Berlin. The Olympic trials track finals would be held in New York in July, and the Olympic Committee would base its selection of competitors on a series of qualifying races. Louis had 7 months to run himself onto the team. In the meantime, he also had to figure out what to do with the numerous college scholarships being offered to him. Pete had won a scholarship to the University of Southern California, where he had become one of the nation's top 10 college milers. He urged Louis to accept USC's offer, but delay entry until the fall so he could train full-time. So Louis moved into Pete's frat house, and with Pete coaching him, trained obsessively. All day, every day, he lived and breathed the 1500 meters and Berlin. In the spring, he began to realize that he wasn't going to make it. Though he was getting faster by the day, he couldn't force his body to improve quickly enough to catch his older rivals by summer. He was simply too young. He was heartbroken. In May, Louis was leafing through a newspaper when he saw a story on the Compton Open, a prestigious track meet to be held at the Los Angeles Coliseum on May 22nd. The headliner in the 5,000 meters, 3 miles and 188 yards, was Norman Bright, a 26-year-old schoolteacher. Bright had set the American 2-mile record in 1935 and was America's second-fastest 5,000-meter man behind the legendary Don Lash, Indiana University's 23-year-old record-smashing machine. America would send 3 5,000-meter men to Berlin, and Lash and Bright were considered locks. Pete urged Louis to enter the Compton Open and try his legs at a longer distance. "If you stay with Norman Bright," he told Louis, "you make the Olympic team." The idea was a stretch. The mile was 4 laps of the track. The 5,000 was more than 12, what Louis would describe as a 15-minute torture chamber, well over 3 times his optimal distance. He had only twice raced beyond a mile, and the 5,000, like the mile, was dominated by much older men. He had only 2 weeks to train for Compton, and with the Olympic trials in July, 2 months to become America's youngest elite 5,000-meter man. But he had nothing to lose. He trained so hard that he rubbed the skin right off one of his toes, leaving his sock bloody. The race, contested before 10,000 fans, was a barn burner. Louis and Bright took off together, leaving the field far behind. Each time one took the lead, the other would gun past him again, and the crowd would roar. They turned into the home stretch for the last time, dead together, Bright inside, Louis outside. Ahead, a runner named John Casey was on the verge of being lapped. Officials waved at Casey, who tried to yield, but Bright and Louis came to him before he could get out of the way. Bright squeezed through on the inside, but Louis had to shift right to go around Casey. Confused, Casey veered farther right, carrying Louis out. Louis sped up to go around him, but Casey sped up also, carrying Louis most of the way toward the grandstand. Finally, Louis took a half step to cut inside, lost his balance, and dropped one hand to the ground. Bright now had an advantage that looked, to Pete's eye, to be several yards. Louis took off after him, gaining rapidly. With the crowd on its feet and screaming, Louis caught Bright at the tape. He was a beat too late. Bright won by a glimmer. He and Louis had clipped out the fastest 5,000 run in America in 1936. Louis's Olympic dream was on again. On June 13th, Louis made quick work of another Olympic 5,000 qualifier, but the toe injured in training opened up again. He was too lame to train for his final qualifying race, and it cost him. Bright beat Louis by 4 yards, but Louis wasn't disgraced, clocking the third fastest 5,000 run in America since 1931. He was invited to the final of the Olympic trials. On the night of July 3rd, 1936, the residents of Torrance gathered to see Louis off to New York. They presented him with a wallet bulging with traveling money, a train ticket, new clothes, a shaving kit, and a suitcase emblazoned with the words, Torrance Tornado. Fearing that the suitcase made him look brash, Louis carried it out of view and covered the nickname with adhesive tape, then boarded his train. According to his diary, he spent the journey introducing himself to every pretty girl he saw, including a total of 5 between Chicago and Ohio. When the train doors slid open in New York, Louis felt as if he were walking into an inferno. It was the hottest summer on record in America, and New York was one of the hardest-hit cities. In 1936, air conditioning was a rarity, found only in a few theaters and department stores, so escape was nearly impossible. That week, which included the hottest 3-day period in the nation's history, the heat would kill 3,000 Americans. In Manhattan, where it would reach 106 degrees, 40 people would die. Louis and Norman Bright split the cost of a room at the Lincoln Hotel. Like all of the athletes, in spite of the heat, they had to train. Sweating profusely day and night, training in the sun, unable to sleep in stifling hotel rooms and YMCAs, lacking any appetite, virtually every athlete lost a huge amount of weight. By one estimate, no athlete dropped less than 10 pounds. One was so desperate for relief that he moved into an air-conditioned theater, buying tickets to movies and sleeping through every showing. Louis was as miserable as everyone else. Chronically dehydrated, he drank as much as he could. After an 880-meter run in 106-degree heat, he downed 8 orangeades and a quart of beer. Each night, taking advantage of the cooler air, he walked 6 miles. His weight fell precipitously. The pre-race newspaper coverage riled him. Don Lash was considered unbeatable, having just taken the NCAA 5,000-meter title for the third time, set a world record at 2 miles and an American record at 10,000 meters, and repeatedly thumped Bright once by 150 yards. Bright was pegged for second, a series of other athletes for third through fifth. Louis wasn't mentioned. Like everyone else, Louis was daunted by Lash, but the first 3 runners would go to Berlin, and he believed he could be among them. If I have any strength left from the heat, he wrote to Pete, I'll beat Bright and give Lash the scare of his life. On the night before the race, Louis lay sleepless in his sweltering hotel room. He was thinking about all the people who would be disappointed if he failed. The next morning, Louis and Bright left the hotel together. The trials were to be held at a new stadium on Randall's Island, at the confluence of the East and Harlem Rivers. It was a hair short of 90 in the city, but when they got off the ferry, they found the stadium much hotter, probably far over 100 degrees. All over the track, athletes were keeling over and being carted off to hospitals. Louis sat waiting for his race, baking under a scalding sun that, he said, made a wreck of me. At last, they were told to line up. The gun cracked, the men rushed forward, and the race was on. Lash bounded to the lead, with Bright in close pursuit. Louis dropped back, and the field settled in for the grind. On the other side of the continent, a throng of Torrancers crouched around the radio in the Zamperini's house. They were in agonies. The start time for Louis's race had passed, but the NBC radio announcer was lingering on the swimming trials. Pete was so frustrated that he considered putting his foot through the radio. At last, the announcer listed the positions of the 5,000-meter runners, but didn't mention Louis. Unable to bear the tension, Louise fled to the kitchen, out of earshot. The runners pushed through laps 7, 8, 9. Lash and Bright led the field. Louis hovered in the middle of the pack, waiting to make his move. The heat was suffocating. One runner dropped, and the others had no choice but to hurdle him. Then another went down, and they jumped him too. Louis could feel his feet cooking. The spikes on his shoes were conducting heat up from the track. Norman Bright's feet were burning particularly badly. In terrible pain, he took a staggering step off the track, twisted his ankle, then lurched back on. The stumble seemed to finish him. He lost touch with Lash. When Louis and the rest of the pack came up to him, he had no resistance to offer. Still, he ran on. As the runners entered the final lap, Lash gave himself a breather, dropping just behind his Indiana teammate, Tom Deckard. Well behind him, Louis was ready to move. Angling into the back stretch, he accelerated. Lash's back drew closer, and then it was just a yard or two ahead. Looking at the bobbing head of the mighty Don Lash, Louis felt intimidated. For several strides, he hesitated. Then he saw the last curve ahead, and the sight slapped him awake. He opened up as fast as he could go. Banking around the turn, Louis drew alongside Lash just as Lash shifted right to pass Deckard. Louis was carried three wide, losing precious ground. Leaving Deckard behind, Louis and Lash ran side by side into the home stretch. With 100 yards to go, Louis held a slight lead. Lash, fighting furiously, stuck with him. Neither man had any more speed to give. Louis could see that he was maybe a hand's width ahead, and he wouldn't let it go. With heads thrown back, legs pumping out of sync, Louis and Lash dove for the tape. With just a few yards remaining, Lash began inching up, drawing even. The two runners, legs rubbery with exhaustion, flung themselves past the judges in a finish so close, Louis later said, "You couldn't put a hair between us." The announcer's voice echoed across the living room in torrents. "Zamperini," he said, "had won." Standing in the kitchen, Louise heard the crowd in the next room suddenly shout. Outside, car horns honked, the front door swung open, and neighbors gushed into the house. As a crush of hysterical torrencers celebrated around her, Louise wept happy tears. Anthony popped the cork on a bottle of wine and began filling glasses and singing out toasts, smiling, said one reveler, like a jackass eating cactus. A moment later, Louis's voice came over the airwaves, calling a greeting to Torrance. But the announcer was mistaken. The judges ruled that it was Lash, not Zamperini, who had won. Deckard had hung on for third. The announcer soon corrected himself, but it hardly dimmed the celebration in Torrance. The hometown boy had made the Olympic team. A few minutes after the race, Louis stood under a cold shower. He could feel the sting of the burns on his feet, following the patterns of his cleats. After drying off, he weighed himself. He had sweated off 3 pounds. He looked in a mirror and saw a ghostly image looking back at him. Across the room, Norman Bright was slumped on a bench with one ankle propped over the other knee, staring at his foot. It, like the other one, was burned so badly that the skin had detached from the sole. He had finished fifth, 2 places short of the Olympic team. By the day's end, Louis had received some 125 telegrams. "Torrance has gone nuts," read one. "Village has gone screwy," read another. There was even one from the Torrance Police Department, which must have been relieved that someone else was chasing Louis. That night, Louis pored over the evening papers, which showed photos of the finish of his race. In some, he seemed to be tied with Lash. In others, he seemed to be in front. On the track, he'd felt sure that he had won. The first three would go to the Olympics. But Louis felt cheated nonetheless. As Louis studied the papers, the judges were reviewing photographs and a film of the 5,000. Later, Louis sent home a telegram with the news. "Judges called it a tie. Leave noon Wednesday for Berlin. We'll run harder in Berlin." When Sylvia returned from work the next day, the house was packed with well-wishers and newsmen. Louis's 12-year-old sister, Virginia, clutched one of Louis's trophies and told reporters of her plans to be the next great Zamperini runner. Anthony headed off to the Kiwanis Club, where he and Louis's Boy Scout master would drink toasts to Louis until 4 in the morning. Pete walked around town to back slaps and congratulations. "Am I ever happy," he wrote to Louis. "I have to go around with my shirt open so that I have enough room for my chest." Louis Zamperini was on his way to Germany to compete in the Olympics in an event that he had only contested 4 times. He was the youngest distance runner to ever make the team. Chapter 4. Plundering Germany. The luxury steamer Manhattan, bearing the 1936 U.S. Olympic team to Germany, was barely past the Statue of Liberty before Louis began stealing things. In his defense, he wasn't the one who started it. Mindful of being a teenaged upstart in the company of such seasoned track deities as Jesse Owens and Glenn Cunningham, Louis curbed his coltish impulses and began growing a